Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Wednesday, May 18th, day number 138 of 2011. And today we're going to be talking about the U.S. economy with our friend Randall Hoven of The American Thinker. We're going to be talking about an article that he wrote and some of his other thoughts on the U.S. economy. And we will be joined as well by Mario Ingerto, who will be checking in with us. Of course, Mario is a local businessman and someone who has followed the economy quite closely. You know, one of the things about this economic recovery, and that's what I want to get into this with Randy and Mario, but one of the things about this economic recovery is how different it is from some of the other economic recoveries that I can remember. It just seems like we're not recovering as fast, and I guess that's my point. We're just not recovering as quickly as we've recovered in other times. So we'll get into that, Randy and Mario, right after this.
Is a recruiting firm located in Dallas, Texas, that specializes in the placement of executives and engineering professionals with companies throughout Texas and Mexico. If your company is seeking quality candidates in the fields of general managers, plant managers, sales, CFOs, or controllers with a manufacturing background, production manager supervisors, engineering, specializing in mechanical, manufacturing, industrial, electrical, safety, or quality engineers, or designer drafters, feel free to contact our team regarding your company's future or current openings. Call Silvio Canto Jr. at 214-483-9505. Email The Canto Group at AOL.com or visit our website, thecantogroup.com.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, and let's say hello to our good friend Randy Hoven. How are you, Randy?
Hey, fine, Silvio. How you doing?
Just absolutely great. Always a lot of fun to talk with you and have a hear your thoughts on the U.S. economy. And you wrote an article recently at The American Thinker about the oil subsidies, and I want to get into that as well with you. But you know, I guess the three big issues on the economy today, Randy, of course, the situation with gas prices, the job creation problems, and the debt ceiling. I'm not sure where to start, but do you have the same sense, Randy? I mean, I'm assuming this is not your first recession. I've been through a couple of that. I can remember the late 70s, that recession. Then came, of course, other recessions. It seems like this one we're having a harder time recovering in this recession. Does it seem the same way to you?
Yes, and I've looked at some of those numbers, and I think of the 11 post-war recessions, this is maybe the top or the worst, not the worst one maybe, but maybe the second worst one. And it looks like it's even as anemic as it is, it looks like it's fizzling out. I mean, the latest growth was really pretty bad, 1.7%. It was down from what it was, and that's not very strong growth at all for this stage of a recovery. I mean, compared to Reagan's, the recovery during Reagan's recession there of, you know, 1983, that was gangbusters, and this is just terrible.
Well, that's exactly right, and that's the comparison that I think a lot of people make, you know, because it is true that we've had 11 recessions, but I think clearly the one that compares maybe closest to this one is 82, which I remember quite well. And you're right, at this time in 1983, we were still maybe technically in a recession, but it felt a lot better. I mean, it felt like The economy was growing in ways that it's not growing now, and you know, in order for us to get back to 5.5% unemployment, Randy, I think I'm sure you've written about this, but it's going to take a lot more than 2% GDP growth in one quarter.
Oh, right, and even Obama's own administration is saying it's going to take years. There's no extrapolation you can make that doesn't say it's going to take at least till 2016 or so just to get back to where we were, and that's under optimistic assumptions.
Right, and I'm not sure that when they made those predictions that they were looking or contemplating the gasoline prices that we will be having coming up here soon. That has changed everything, hasn't it?
The gas prices just seem to be a perfect like control mechanism. Like as soon as we start recovering, the gas prices get better and make the recovery fizzle out some, and then as soon as the recession gets worse or the recovery gets worse, gas prices will go down some, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
It's like almost a perfect counter controlling, you know, negative feedback kind of thing.
Yeah, well, the situation with gas prices, this is when, you know, when you're sitting there projecting what the economy is going to do at a certain point, gasoline prices are the kinds of things that you never know when they're going to happen, because you never know when, you know, there's going to be a revolution in Egypt. You never know when there's going to be trouble in the Middle East, and no one could foresee that kind of a situation. But Randy, before we get to the topics, though, why don't you give us a little update on some of the activities? I know I read you often in American Thinker, and just fill us in what you've been doing lately. What are you writing about? And just kind of give us a little catch up.
Well, for one, I was busy most of the spring. I was teaching two courses at college, so I only started kind of picking up in my writing in the last month or so. Monday I wrote an article that probably made anybody who used to like me not like me anymore. I kind of wrote a defense of Obama. Not that I really am defending him, but there's a lot of numbers you could use that we genuinely are in recovery. And, you know, the National Bureau of Economic Research said the recession ended in June of 2009, which is just 5 months into his term of office. There's a lot of things he can say, and he has been saying some of it, that you can make him look good. You know, the recession ended shortly after he got in. We've had 14 months of positive job growth on down the line. And I don't believe any of this. I actually think his stimulus hurt, not helped. In fact, there's that recent study that said it cost over 500,000 jobs.
Right.
You probably know that one. You see, it created almost 500,000 jobs in the government, but it destroyed about 1 million jobs in the private sector.
Yeah,
so
I
don't think anything he did caused any good news. All recessions have ended.
Right.
Most of the times we don't do anything in particular to make them stop. And I think it would have stopped this time. He didn't have to do anything. The thing he did was a stimulus, primarily, and that hurt more than it helped.
Right. Well, I think that's the problem, that it would be very difficult for him to say that, you know, or to take credit for the fact that the economy or the recession ended in June, because that would not, then what's the point of the stimulus? If the recession ended in June, what was the point of stimulating the economy 2 months or 3 months?
Right. Most of the stimulus money was spent after the recession technically ended.
That's right. That's right. So I think that's why. That's why I don't think they're talking up that particular point. But the article that you refer to, I think it's the one that that I read myself. It was in the Wall Street Journal, and if you want to read it, it's 36 pages long. By the way, I was thinking about printing it for so I could read it and make some notes. But it's 36 pages long, so make sure you have enough paper in your printer, anybody, if you want to print this. It's a long PDF file, but yeah, it basically says that. It says, look, you know, more jobs were created in the public sector, and that's why, and you and I, it's funny about this, you and I talked about this a couple of years ago when there was the big debate about the stimulus, and the idea is that it stimulated the public sector. What it basically did is that it kept a lot of jobs going in the public sector, and it didn't really stimulate the private sector, which is what I think the Reagan plan did. The reason the Reagan recovery was better is because it was being stimulated by the private sector. That's what I think.
And even as a stimulus, it wasn't very good. It really, if you look at where the money went, very little of it actually went to, you know, infrastructure and things that this so-called shovel-ready business, you know, it didn't go to construction and things like that for the most part. The biggest part was just bailing out states from their own, you know, fiscal irresponsibility. Largely, you know, they helped them states pay for Medicare and their own education programs. It was just kind of a staving off of the catastrophe we all know is going to happen in the states.
Right. Well, but that was it, though, and that's what I was talking to a lady the other day. You know, she was telling me that, you know, she was giving me the party line that Obama saved us from a Great Depression, and I said, well, first of all, you cannot really prove that, but beyond that, what he did basically is that he sent a lot of money to the states, and it probably saved a few teaching jobs, maybe, as you say, paid for Medicare, but that's over now.
Right,
so
and
that,
every dollar he sent anybody was borrowed. All we did was borrow more money, and now we're, you know, in the top 10 of countries in the world that are in debt, you know, in
right.
the size of our debt. And, you know, everybody's warning about that. That's the main thing we need to fight, and he just made that situation worse.
Yeah, I mean, if I could use an analogy, what he did is that he used one credit card to pay off the other one, basically. I mean,
right.
Maybe that's a simplistic analogy, but that's
kind of what it is. The analogy I like is trying to fill up the deep end of the pool by taking buckets out of the shallow end.
Okay. That's a good one, too. But speaking of the debt, let me see if I understand this correctly. A couple of days ago, the debt ceiling authority ended, right? So we don't have the authority to borrow any more money over whatever we agreed to last year, which is $14 trillion. So we were told that the world was going to come to an end, Randy, a couple of days ago. It didn't. And here we are now. How are we operating the country? How are we operating the government now? We do not have the ability to borrow any money. So at some point here, something has to happen.
I think so far Geithner is doing some, you could call it shenanigans, to get us to August 2nd, I think he said. And it's mainly government, intra-government borrowing. Like, the Treasury is borrowing from government pension funds to fund its other operations so that it's still more debt, but it's all internal government debt, I think. You know, this is kind of above my head, but it's bookkeeping tricks like that that keep us afloat for another 2 months.
So we're taking money from the copy department and we're moving it to the other department, but eventually we're going to run out of money.
And part of that $14 trillion is what one side of government owes the other, you know, right? The general side of government still owes Social Security and Medicare. That's what the trust funds are. All they are IOUs from one part of the government to the other. Mm. So part of that $14 trillion is that kind of debt. What we owe outside of the government is a lesser amount, but it's still a huge amount. It's 70%+ of GDP, which is, I think, eighth highest in the developed world right now. We're not quite Greece, but we're close.
Well, we're certainly headed in that direction. That's the tragedy there. But the debt ceiling, if we were to let's say, agree to raising the debt ceiling without having significant cuts and significant reductions in spending, I think that would be a huge mistake. In other words, I really do believe we have to say, okay, this is it. This is the moment. If we're going to raise the ceiling, we're going to have major cuts. That's my position. Have you been covering
mine
this?
As well. I agree with Paul Ryan and I forget the investor's name, but there's, you know, especially if it's only a so-called technical default, which just means there's days or maybe a week or two where bonds aren't paid off, that general bond investors will live with that if they know the long-term situation has improved. You know, we can live without a payment for another week or two if we know we're going to get paid over the long term anyway. What really scares the investors is that the debt has become irresponsible and long term it cannot be paid off. That's the real threat, not just a few days of late payments.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and that's what scares a lot of people, and that's why you were using the analogy of Greece. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and we're talking to our good friend Randy Hoven, contributor to The American Thinker, and we check with Randy from time to time. We're going to be joined by Mario Ingurto later, But maybe Mario is still recovering from the Miami Heat losing game one the other night. I'll have to check with him when he calls in. He's one of the biggest fans of the Miami Heat in the whole country. Now, you wrote an article, Randy, about oil subsidies.
The oil subsidies, I was just going to bring that up.
Very interesting article because I think, you know, the oil companies are an easy target. Politically, they're a very easy target. But I've always felt that they've been unfairly criticized, and I say that I don't have any connection to the oil companies. I've never done a deal with oil companies. I've never received a penny from oil companies. I just buy gasoline like anybody else or oil products. But I just think they've been targeted unfairly by politicians. So tell me about that article. I think it's
obvious demagoguery, but okay, I'll talk about that article. Well, first, I had a question all this time. I kept hearing about our subsidies to the oil company, and I kept asking myself, what subsidies? What are you talking about? You mean we actually pay oil company subsidies? You know, I know about ethanol and some other things where we actually, the government writes checks to these people to do things. When it comes to oil subsidies, all they're talking about are so-called tax breaks. And so it's not really a subsidy. It's money uncollected from oil company earnings. And when you look at them, for one thing, it's not that much money. It's $4 billion a year, which, you know, it's even less than earmarks. It's very much a distraction of any real budget problem or debt problem or any of that. But when you look at how they break down, what are those tax breaks? Most of it, probably more than three-quarters of the so-called tax breaks, are nothing even peculiar to the oil company. They're just tax breaks that all corporations get. In fact, one of them was a tax break to try to keep factories in the United States. So do we not want that to happen? And if you sing about oil companies, how do you do that? How do you say only oil companies are not going to get this tax break? I even call that a bill of attainder. That's something that's unconstitutional. You can't single out particular people, I don't think, or even particular industries, I don't think, and say you're the only one that gets screwed this way.
Right. But it's sort of like the waivers for Obamacare, like the big story here in the last 24 hours about all these waivers in Nancy Pelosi's district. But the waivers in general, I don't think that's constitutional either. But let's get back to your...
Then you look at what you know, everybody talks about oil companies make huge profits and it's always growing, et cetera. Well, they just sell lots of gasoline. As a percent of revenues, they're not even in the top half of profits as a fraction of revenues. It's like 6.3% or something like that, which is not, like I said, it's not even average. And they pay one of the highest tax rates of any industry. They pay something like 45% of all profits go to taxes. And I think the average industry, it's maybe 25%. And then you look at what do they do with the profits that they do keep. And I think 75% of that goes back into exploration and development. And there's a lot of that stuff going on. Now that, you know, I don't know all the technologies, but shale and sand oil and all that kind of stuff, and deeper wells in the ocean, et cetera, those things cost money, and somebody has to do that, and we ought to be thankful that the oil companies are doing that. Another little factor is when you go to pay to fill up your tank, most of the money that you gave to that gas station went to taxes, then went to oil company profits and even some of their costs. You can just kind of go on and on. Another thing, if people think if oil companies, they're just getting rich because they sit on a bunch of oil, they own oil. Actually, the oil companies themselves own almost no oil in the world. Something like 87% of all oil in the ground is owned by states and countries. It's government-owned.
Right.
What Exxon owns in terms of oil sitting in the ground is not even 1% of the world's reserves. Venezuela has like over 7% just by itself. So what the oil companies do is the actual work of getting oil out of the ground to your gas tank. You know, they do things. They ship it. They dig wells, etc. They actually do things. That's what they're getting paid to do. They're not just sitting on capital, which I think a bunch of people believe is how oil companies make money.
In fact, Randy, there was a graph, and maybe you did it or somebody else did it. There was a graph that I saw recently here in the last 30 days that something like 94%, you said 87, but 94 is the figure I saw, which is a very similar figure to yours. 94% is actually, like you're saying, controlled by government. There's a lot of governments around the world with huge deposits of oil, and very often what the oil companies of the United States, as well as some of the other private companies, they're the ones that have to go in and drill for it. And as I've spoken to petroleum engineers, and they tell me, I mean, there's no guarantee that you drill and you find oil.
Right.
Very times you drill and there's nothing down there, and you got to drill somewhere else. And you know, all of these things are very expensive. It's very expensive. Again, I have no particular love for oil companies any more than I love computer companies. They're just businesses.
Nor do I.
I mean,
as well, that I don't get a dime from them.
Yeah,
you know,
I never
people
have.
People think if you say anything good about the oil companies, you must be getting paid by them. If they want to, they can pay me.
Right, exactly. They can pay me for speaking the truth anytime they want to. But
right. But
you're exactly right. I mean, these companies are being targeted by very foolish politicians. And I mean, I was at a breakfast a couple of weeks ago, and I got up to defend the oil company. Somebody said, well, you must work for one. I said, not at all. I'm not here to defend oil companies. I've never made a dime for them. I'm here to defend free markets and capitalism, because I said to them, what's the alternative to a private company? The alternative is Petro Obama. And Petro Obama means that everybody who works at Petro Obama is going to have to be a member of the union, and they're all going to be sending money to the Democrat Party. That's the reason that these people don't like private companies. It's because
they
cannot unionize them.
And there's one little funny thing. All this talk about subsidies to U.S. oil companies, one place we're loaning, I think via the Ex-Im Bank or something, but like $2 billion is to Petrobras, I think.
Petrobras Brazil, yeah.
In Brazil to develop their offshore oil. You know,
that's
you know,
right.
We don't want to drill in our ocean, but we'll loan money to Brazil to drill in their ocean, then buy their gas, their oil that we don't want to buy for our. And not to mention a lot of oil companies. Shell is a Dutch company, the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
BP is British Petroleum. They're based
right.
in Britain. I think Norway has some. So we have Exxon, but there's nothing that says they have to be in the United States, you know? Halliburton moved to UAE, I believe.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And
you know, you want to keep jobs in the U.S.? There's nothing that says these companies have to work in the U.S. They're global companies.
That's exactly right, and that's the fear. In fact, one of the things that I thought was very interesting, Randy, was that, and I saw this in a news report, that some of the labor unions sent a letter to the Senate Democrats saying, hey, guys, slow down a little bit, because you're going to cost us jobs, because these companies actually
and
do
those
employ
well-paid jobs.
That's exactly right.
Anybody would want to work for an oil company.
And you're exactly right.
Not just the executives either.
No, you're right. I mean, they hire probably more engineers. I always said that the company that probably hires more engineers, or the industry that probably hires more engineers than any other, is the oil industry. Well, Randy, that's about it for us today. But I want to just kind of briefly ask you a question. What do you think is going to happen with the debt ceiling? Do you think that they will reach a deal, or do you think that they won't? What's your gut feeling?
I think there will be something they can call a deal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a whole lot of hope for the GOP nowadays. I think they will. They always fold. I think the safe bets are to bet against the GOP, but I think they'll have enough of a deal that everybody can save face somehow. But in real life, it won't be much of a deal at all. It'll be like the last deal they had, where they said they were going to cut $100 billion. It turned out to be like not even a billion.
Wow. Well, let me ask you another question. Can you give us a little preview of the next article you're working on?
I was just writing it today, and it's more about foreign policy and the war on terror. And I think something significant changed with Petraeus going to CIA and getting Osama bin Laden and all that.
Well, I think it's interesting. I just heard the story that President Obama is going to be going to the CIA tomorrow to congratulate the people there for the great intelligence job that they did in catching bin Laden.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a bit ironic that he would do that, because this is a an administration that, you know, that in some cases they're still investigating, although I don't think it'll ever happen, these CIA people. And I just think it's a bit ironic. Maybe he'll go there and thank them for... Now, here's a bet. Would you bet anything on this? He'll go there and thank him for waterboarding the terror? Wouldn't that be something? Yeah, wouldn't that be something? Wouldn't that be something that he goes there and he says, we thank you so much for waterboarding that SOB, and that's how we got...
If you can't even get John McCain to say waterboarding had, you know, something to do with that intelligence, you're never going to get Obama to say it.
That's right, and that's one time that John McCain disappointed me. Maybe another time that he disappointed me.
One of many, yes.
Randy, thank you so much for joining us today. It's always a pleasure, and we love reading your articles, and you have a great day. And
thank you,
we'll catch up at another time. Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
See you later. We're going to take a little break, and we'll be right back.
Canto Group is a recruiting firm located in Dallas, Texas that specializes in the placement of executives and engineering professionals with companies throughout Texas and Mexico. If your company is seeking quality candidates in the fields of general managers, plant managers, sales, CFOs, or controllers with a manufacturing background, production managers and supervisors, engineering specializing in mechanical manufacturing, industrial, electrical, safety, or quality engineers, or designers and drafters, feel free to contact our team regarding your company's future or current openings. Call Silvio Canto Jr. at 214-483-9505. Email thecantogroup@aol.com or visit our website, thecantogroup.com.
This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and I want to thank once again our good friend Randy Hoban of The American Thinker for joining us today. I guess Mario... I don't know what happened to Mario. Maybe he's still recovering from the loss of the Miami Heat the other night. Mario is the biggest fan of the Miami Heat in the world, and I'm sure he'll check with us later. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas saying thank you very much for listening, and we'll talk to you the next time. Have a great day.